Dana Frank is a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and she is the author of the book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. Dana Frank, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio program.
Oh, thanks so much. It's always such a joy and an honor to be on your show, Mitch. And thanks also to Diana Martinez, the producer, for all her wonderful work as well.
She's the one that makes it happen. She never gets all the credit, but she deserves it all. Now, Dana Frank, we could easily spend the hour talking about just the last decade by itself and trying to understand why people are coming north requesting asylum. And again, we could talk about the ouster of Manuel Zelaya in 2009, and we will talk about those things. But as you know, we like to take the long look here. So we want to begin with when the United States really first started getting involved in Honduras. This is the early 20th century and the United Fruit Company. What's important to know about that story?
Well, the United Fruit Company was one of the classic early transnational U.S.-based corporations that was known as El Pulpo, or the octopus, because it was so enormous. It had a fleet of ships. It had it was in multiple countries throughout Latin America. It had its Central American headquarters in Honduras and was certainly the most powerful political force in Honduras throughout the 20th century. It starts with mergers of various companies, but is in its current form by the 1920s when it starts to employ workers by the tens of thousands on highly exploited banana plantations throughout the north coast of Honduras, as well as in Guatemala, Panama, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Colombia, all over.
The United Fruit Company, is that Chiquita now?
Yeah, it becomes Chiquita, I think, in the 1970s. And the United Fruit Company was very much tied in with U.S. elites, very famously John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State in the 1950s, and his brother Alan, who was the head of the CIA. They were both lawyers for the United Fruit Company in that period. So there's very direct connections between U.S. imperial and military policy and the U.S.-based corporation United Fruit and its investments and domination of Honduras. And in Honduras in particular, there was the phrase the Banana Republic is about these kinds of countries, although I want to underscore that Hondurans today consider the phrase Banana Republic a pejorative insult. So I don't myself use it, but I want to market that this is where that phrase came from. And the United Fruit Company ruled Honduras for decades, from the 1920s well into the 70s or so, and had enormous power over the Honduran government.
What does it mean to rule for the United Fruit Company to rule for 50 years a country?
Well, the Honduran government certainly was in thrall to it, and it also dominated the physical space. For example, the Honduran government gave it railroad concessions and land around the railroad so they could build a national railroad, but the railroad only went from United Fruit banana plantations to the ports controlled by United Fruit. There's another player in here, which was also Standard Fruit, which is not as big globally, but was very important in Honduras as well, in the Aguan Valley in particular, which is very important today. And it's what later became Dole. So those two corporations were both very powerful. And their headquarters was like the national government almost in La Lima, outside San Pedro Sula.
Does Chiquita and even Dole still have a presence in Honduras today?
Yeah, they do. They have largely subcontracted most of their production, but certainly there are depends on how you count, because so much of it is through subcontractors. But maybe there's about 40,000 banana workers that work for the subsidiary, or 30,000. Don't quote me on this. The work for the current version of Dole and Chiquita, which then also subcontract. But they have a tremendous investment in modernized packing plants, particularly Dole. And so they definitely have an economic presence. They don't have the sign of political power that they did in the earlier decades. In fact, when the coup happened in 2009, there were a lot of people that said, oh, let's blame Chiquita, when actually there is no evidence linking Chiquita and Dole to the coup. They actually have work closely with Honduran unions in a combative sense, but they have a lot invested in a certain kind of economic stability in Honduras that would not necessarily have led them to have supported the coup.
Yeah. Do you think oftentimes, and going back to history, not right now, when I think of the United Fruit Company, I oftentimes think of it as and compare it to try to understand the role that the United Fruit Company played in the early 20th century in Latin America. I oftentimes think of the British East Indian Company and the role that that played for Britain's colonial adventures in India and throughout Asia. Do you think that's an appropriate comparison to look at?
Yeah, you know, and United also Fruit one Company of the colonialism way? References helps us understand the actual social and cultural politics of the United Fruit Company in Honduras, because they have this classic enclave where it was called the Zona Americana, or the American Zone, in La Lima, where their headquarters were. And they had explicit racial policies about who was allowed in. They had all these sort of welfare state for their white employees, and those they chose to mark as white and were allowed special recreational privileges. And those were managers and some white collar worker women. And then below that were those they marked as mestizo Hondurans that were allowed special privileges, and those who identified as being of African descent were banned from all kinds of housing and privileges. So they had this institutionalized racism system in Honduras, and very similar to the systems that were in place during the building of the Panama Canal in the 20th century.
Now, 1954 is a very important year in Honduran modern history. Two things that I want to talk about. The first, well, actually, I want to talk about this later, but one, there's a major general strike by banana workers, and we'll get to that. But in 1954, it's also where in Honduras that the United States used its bases to help overthrow the democratically elected socialist president of Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz. Tell me the importance of that story.
Well, Arbenz is very important also for the United Fruit Company, because he was beginning to nationalize land that was fallow land. And because there's so many diseases that wipe out banana plantations because it's monoculture, so it's not a balanced environment, ecological system. United Fruit owned tens of thousands of acres of land in Guatemala, but wasn't using them. It was just holding it in case they wanted it for banana plantations for expansion or replacement. So what Arbenz did was he announced he was going to nationalize the land, the fallow land of the United Fruit Company, that and I want to underscore, and pay back the United Fruit Company for more than the value of the land. And that's what prompted the 1954 invasion of Guatemala by the United States, of course, led by the United Fruit Company lawyer, who was Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, and his brother Alan Dulles, also United Fruit Company lawyer, who was head of the CIA. So here's our Honduras and Guatemala merge here, because the U.S. used Honduras as a base, as the military base, to put together the force and then invade Guatemala to successfully overthrow the government of Arbenz in 1954. So that is like the first base time we see Honduras used as a base sometimes the Honduras ends up being called the USS Honduras, as if it was itself a military base, and successfully overthrew that government of Guatemala, ushering in decades and decades of decades of repression and genocide in Guatemala ever since.
And again, because the United Fruit Company is probably the major political power in Honduras in 1954, and because the United Fruit Company has great interest in overthrowing Arbenz in Guatemala, that explains why they were able to use bases in Honduras.
Yeah, but it's also in 1954, right before, maybe a month or 3 weeks before the invasion of Guatemala, the United States signed a treaty with Honduras to jointly operate Sotocano Air Force Base at Palmarola in Honduras. And the version of that treaty is still in force with very little transparency. So that tight cooperation and, in fact, co-management of a military base in Honduras starts in 1954 as part of locking down what was necessary for the invasion of an overthrow of the government of socialist government government, democratically elected, I would underscore, socialist government of Jacobo Arbenz in 1954.
It almost sounds like during this period of time that the Honduras is almost like a satellite state to the United States administered by a private company.
Well, absolutely. Although there are also other economic interests, the El Rosario Mining Company, which was pulling money out in the extractive industries out of Honduras. But there's also this connection between other connection, which is the Honduran general strike of 1954 that you mentioned, because the timing is really exact and these things don't usually get put together. But in 1954, there was a general strike. Now, it starts on May 1st of 1954, a few weeks before the invasion of Guatemala, and it spreads very quickly, and it was a huge surprise to everyone involved. And eventually, 65,000 people went out and strike in Honduras, almost the entire industrial labor force, including all the banana plantation and related workers of Standard Fruit and United Fruit, paralyzing the whole country for 6 weeks. And Standard Fruit settled after 3 weeks, but United Fruit not for 6 weeks. And that was sent shockwaves into the Department of State in the United States, because they did not see this coming. And this is right as they're planning for a year to invade Guatemala. So part of that military pact, which has extremely important implications ever since with Fort Sotocano Air Force Base in Honduras, is partly because they're locking things down before that invasion, because they're worried about communism in Honduras. Now, they already have socialism in front of them, or beginnings of socialism in Guatemala, and then suddenly there's this general strike, which does have leadership by communists and others, and they are completely flipping out about losing economic and political power in Central America very suddenly because of this general strike in 1954, which is, you know, the great moment from which all Honduran history flows, because it's this great moment of pride and enormous power that led to the forms of the Honduran labor code and welfare state and national health service that were then put in place in its aftermath, in its shadow, that are now being gutted since the coup.
This is an important point, and actually I found really interesting the aftermath of this 1954 general strike. It actually did improve, or at least was supposed to improve, with the agreements that were reached with these companies, the conditions of workers and really overall people in Honduras. And I guess this was in order to keep the spread of ideas of socialism or even
not
communism.
Just the ideas of, but yeah, actual practices of. And what the U.S. did is they created these, working with the AFL-CIO at the time, and I want to underscore that now the AFL-CIO is tremendous about Honduras and has been really out there condemning the coup and really terrific in the modern period, so I want to understand that.
But a very different situation in the 1950s.
But at the time, the AFL-CIO was under right-wing control and was working with the CIA, with the State Department very closely, and the solution, quote-unquote, from the U.S. side to the general strike was to work with the AFL-CIO to impose collaborationist unions that would then sign contracts with the government. And now it's interesting, though, because so that's how they resolve the general strike, is to impose unions that become very strong. They're the biggest unions in Central America for decades and the roots of the modern labor movement in Honduras today. And they achieve really substantial gains, health care, paid vacations, a lump sum retirement, subsidized housing, subsidized by USAID, the Agency for International Development. It's a packet of that was very much designed to prevent communism, and in many ways it did. And I actually have seen in the National Archives a letter from the U.S. ambassador to Honduras, to John Foster Dulles in Washington, D.C., the Secretary of State, saying, "I just met with the head of United Fruit for Honduras, and I told him, either you accept the unions or you have communism." And United Fruit soon after recognized the unions and signed contracts with them. So you can see it was very clearly that these unions came in, but they were not what we would think of as an independent union. But there was also, because the United States was worried and controlled the Honduran government, not entirely, but was concerned about revolution in Honduras and throughout Central America and Latin America, In the aftermath of the 1954, there was a somewhat more centrist as opposed to right-wing government And under that government, the labor code was introduced, introducing labor laws. The National Health Service was introduced that created a system of hospitals and health care that was pretty good for those in the formal sector of the economy, and other elements of what we would, it's sort of like the New Deal moment for Honduras. And that window is going to close in 1963 with a military coup. But during that brief moment of the late 50s and early 60s, certain institutional advances are brought as part of this pact to keep out communism. So it's this threat. And of course, the Cuban Revolution in 1959 is also what gets money. You know, then the U.S. really sits up straight and starts pouring money into these kinds of programs in Honduras because they're worried about the whole thing blowing up.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of the book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror in the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. And we are in conversation about the history of U.S. involvement in Honduras. Dana Frank, what was significant about the 1963 military coup? And was the United States involved in that?
Well, I'm sure it was. We don't. I don't know the smoking gun on that in particular, but and partly because some of the archival materials aren't available. I'm sure they were. And it was that in 1963, there was a military coup that is, of course, the first big one before 2009. And it institutes a joint military government working with also the National Party of Honduras, one of the two right-wing parties that have ruled Honduras for decades. And that ushers in military control of the government. There are elections, but they're not particularly legitimate. That ushers in military control of the Honduran government until 1982, when civilian elections are restored. And in that period, the military is controlling Honduras. In 1982, there is a new constitution, and then you start having a somewhat legitimate electoral process. But again, with the National Party and the ruling party, the National Party and the Liberal Party, the two right-wing parties, in backroom deals, trading off power, creating the illusion of democracy. Now, in the 80s, the military is pushed back somewhat from its role, and that's why you get the Constitution of 1982, the one in force now, with some amendments, does restrict the military to stay out of domestic policing. It does in some ways very clearly restrict the military in response to that military period of tremendous repression between 63 and 82.
The 1980s is also important, as you mentioned, the return of civilian rule, but there would be the civilian leaders would also be deposed by the military during this period of time. The 1980s is very significant for understanding the Contra War in Nicaragua. Help me make sense of what's going on with Honduras, Nicaragua, and the United States in the 1980s.
Great. You know, again, to understand Honduras, you have to think regionally then as now. Well, when the Sandinistas came to power in Nicaragua in 1979, the U.S., went into a tremendous aggressive response to that when Ronald Reagan is elected president in 1980. And he launches what is known as the Contra War against the Sandinistas, pouring U.S. funds in there. And this was what the Iran-Contra scandal is about, because the U.S. Channeled money through Iran to the Contras when Congress started balking about Reagan and the Contra War. The Honduras piece of this is that Honduras, once again, as in 1954 in the invasion of Guatemala, becomes the base for the U.S. military intervention. Bloody, bloody years and years of military intervention in the Contra War against the Sandinistas and the government of Nicaragua. Here's when Soto Cano Air Force Base in Palmarola, known popularly at the time as Palmarola, becomes the military base where the planes are launched from. It remains the only place the U.S. can land the big planes in Central America still to this day. And this is when the Honduras is known as, or becomes known as, the USS Honduras. Now, in this period, the Honduran, for complicated reasons having to do with the outcome of the general strike, but also because there had been land reform to a certain extent in Honduras during the 1970s, we don't have the same armed uprising on the same scale.
You don't have a civil war in Honduras when you do all around it.
No, there's not. But there is. And it's being locked down by the U.S. military during this during the Contra War. But there is a very active and vocal and powerful left there in Honduras, nonetheless. That is also involved in supporting movements in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, particularly by Nicaragua by this period in El Salvador. So, in response to that, something in the Honduran military. There's something called Battalion 316, which was the death squad battalion within the Honduran military, and that committed tremendous assassinations of hundreds of Honduran leftists. And they would even, there would be a guy that would sit in the airport and identify leftists that came and went, and then they would disappear, including family members, partners, brothers of friends of mine today that are Hondurans, and very famous Battalion 316, very terrifying. And in 1995, Ginger Thompson and Gary Cohn, writing for the Baltimore Sun, did a tremendous series of stories about Battalion 316, in which they documented that the U.S. ambassador to Honduras, John Negroponte, who's still out there crawling around in Washington, D.C., that John Negroponte knew all about Battalion 316, lied to Congress, was actively trying to disrupt peace talks, and knew about these assassinations by this battalion of the Honduran military. And, of course, the U.S. is continuing to fund the Honduran military as well as the Contras throughout this period. So we have this very dangerous and bloody period of U.S. support for death squads in Honduras. And some of those figures have reappeared in Honduras since the 2009 coup.
And of course, John Negroponte would become an important figure for the George W. Bush administration.
Absolutely.
20 years later. In, what is it, 1988, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights finds the Honduran government guilty of disappearances of citizens between 1981 and 1984. This is when the period of time that John Negroponte is there, and as you say, knows about this. Who has disappeared and why?
Well, one is, I'm forgetting his name, the husband of Alberto Oliva, very famously, was disappeared. He was a union activist and a leftist, and he was disappeared in the early 80s. And the brother of Ilsa the brother of Samantha Velasquez, and many, many people that were disappeared that were, and I'm sorry, I can't rattle off the names.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Process of historical memory, if you go to the office of COFADE, the Committee of Families of Disappeared and Detained in Honduras, you'll see their images are everywhere, and people very much keep these stories alive within Honduras.
Again, the issue, when we say that the United States is using military bases in Honduras in order to support the Contras in Nicaragua, and the Contras are right-wing counter-revolutionaries and to the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Well, what does that necessarily mean? What was the U.S. involvement in that? And is La Chiquita still involved in this, or is this now the government, U.S. government, doing it by itself without the interest of these international companies?
I don't think it's specifically about the transnational corporations or the U.S. corporations driving it. It's more like the U.S. has this geopolitical drive to dominate Latin America, and of course much of the whole world. So it's more like, by this point, it's like they just don't want anybody that's going to challenge U.S. power and U.S. military power and the whole transnational corporate extractive exploitative model. And so it's about keeping the whole model in place and keeping the U.S. in domination of the whole region. And Honduras has always been their most locked down captive country.
Are the gains that are made after the 54 strike and in what we'd almost call the Honduras New Deal, are these all done? Are these all gone by this period of
time?
They're
not completely gone. No, they're certainly not gone in the 1980s. When they start being chipped away at is actually in the 1990s when neoliberal governments, particularly that of Ricardo Maduro, who comes before Zelaya in the early 2000s, and these neoliberal governments, they're the ones that start chipping away at them. They're the ones that start throwing out an overriding agrarian reform laws that had redistributed land to campesino collectives. They're the ones that start chipping away at the welfare state. It's the neoliberals. And of course, there you can see the role of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the Inter-American Development and the global neoliberal model that's starting to be imposed throughout Latin America, Africa, and other parts of the world.
And this is chipping away at those programs and privatizing them, right? I mean, what do we mean by here comes the neoliberals? What happens?
Well, the neoliberals say, well, you borrowed this money and you can't pay it back. And, you know, we really need to be able, if we're going to give you even another loan. And, of course, these governments are many ways corrupt. And so they want their hands on this money. And so they say, okay, we will streamline our government and we will design our economy in certain ways to follow your dictates. But those dictates also interlock with the interests of the Honduran elites. For example, Miguel Facuse, who passed away a couple years ago, but was the richest man in the country for decades. And he started forcing people in campesino collectives off their land in the Aguan Valley and violating the industrial reform laws, and he's getting money from the World Bank for his Dinant Corporation, and that's the kind of model that says that, well, this would be more efficient if we had palm oil plantations, which destroy the environment because they suck all the water out, they destroy good jobs because they have very low labor force needs, and also they're being imposed at the point of a gun, especially when we get into the 2000s.
Tell me about the 2000s, and there are still death squads operating.
Yeah, I mean, the death squads are, you know, I do want to say that they are, the repression is at bay. I mean, it's all relative. But when I first started coming to Honduras in 2000, if you look at just the decade before the coup, so the first, so if you say 1998 through 2008, and I, you know, to track these statistics in COFADE, there's maybe 20 people are assassinated for political reasons in the whole decade before the coup. Now, of course, there's hundreds that are going to be assassinated beginning with the coup. So it's actually a period of relative peace. In fact, if you cross the border into Guatemala in this period, it's like there's young men with and women, too, in camo with rifles everywhere, both the military and the narcos and the police and private actors. And that was not true in Honduras in the early 2000s. And there were very few assassinations of environmental activists and of one trade union leader. But other than that, it was a relatively safe place, and also for journalists and human rights defenders in general. So it's not like there's a golden age in Honduras before the coup, but it is night and day what it meant to be a social activist. And you did not spend your time worrying about being assassinated, except in a few rural regions.
Well, I'm looking at a report right here from 2001 by the Honduran Committee for the Defense of Human Rights that says that more than 1,000 street children were murdered in 2000 by death squads.
Now, that's a different story. That is about the mano duro, or hard hand or hard fist policies of the neoliberals. And then we're talking about especially when you get into Ricardo Maduro, who's president from 2002 to 2006. And they start having, there's certainly a tremendous poverty in Honduras. And this is when you start having Honduran police involved in death squad activity, often against street children or young men in gangs.
So the Honduran police are participating in death squad activities against children living on the streets?
Well, this is these like social cleansing policies, which we know about from other countries, and also the sort of hard fist that somehow these people need to be cleaned up. I mean, in 2003, we have this documented. There was a man named El Tigre Bonilla, who would later become the national director of police in 2012, brought in to supposedly clean up the police. And there was actually an investigation of him in 2003 when he was a mid to high level police officer. And we have people talking about being on the phone with him while he approved killings of gang members and youth in San Pedro Sula. So And I think it was in San Pedro Sula. I mean, that's documented. He was investigated and then relieved of his responsibilities in 2003 because of that. So we know that this kind of death squad activity was going on in the police, directed against gangs and against young people in general.
Does the United States know about this?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yes, they knew about it at the time because they certainly knew about El Tigre Bonilla because... Now, how is it that I know this? In the WikiLeaks, you can see, and this is in my book, I found this fairly recently, that in the WikiLeaks, you can see that when El Tigre Bonilla was charged, and the woman who charged him and investigated him was named Maria Luisa Borjas, who's now a Congress member for Libre, and when she did her investigation and she said that, and the embassy, there's actually an embassy cable to Washington in which they say that she should be protected and El Tigre Bonilla should be immediately removed, and I can't remember exactly what they say, and that Oscar Alvarez, who was the Minister of Security at the time, should be told to protect her. And then what actually happened is Alvarez fired Maria Luisa Borjas, who did the investigation, El Tigre Bonilla, it was much later in 2012, going to be celebrated by the U.S. ambassador for the work he's supposedly going to do cleaning up the police. And then at that point, Congress balks and about funding to Honduras. And the U.S. says, oh, well, we're investigating El Tigre Bonilla. We'll see what we can find out. When, of course, they had known since 2003 that he was a death squad leader in the Honduran police.
Dana Frank is professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of the new book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror in the United States, and the Aftermath of the Coup. We are in conversation about the history of U.S. involvement in Honduras and why it may pertain to the reason that so many people are now coming north and asking for asylum here in the United States. Dana Frank, we're down to probably our last 12 minutes here or so, and I want to really bring it in together, and because I think there are people who know and think, okay, I get the sense that the history is important in understanding why so many people are coming here. I just need to understand the argument. So let's start making that argument by looking in the last 10 years, in which really your book focuses a lot on. I think in the middle of the 2000s, you have the election of Manuel Zelaya. 4 years later, he would be deposed. The importance of that.
I would just say he's deposed 3 years later.
3 years later,
2009.
Forgive me.
Well, Zelaya was a member of the elite and one of the two ruling parties. He was no flaming leftist, but he was starting to, he was elected in 2006. And when he was president, he was starting to lean center left somewhat. He raised the minimum wage by 50%. He was aligning himself with the new democratically elected center left and left governments of South America and Central America coming to power in these same years. And he also blocked privatizations by the Honduran elites who wanted to take over and profit from Honduran state-run institutions. And so he was deposed in this June 28th, 2000 coup by the military, the Supreme Court, and the majority of Congress, and that flew him on a military plane to Costa Rica. He was at the time had put, there was an election going on that day called the Cuarta Urna, or the fourth ballot box, which was an opinion poll that the president has a right to put on a ballot, asking if people wanted to elect delegates to a constitutional convention in the future, and it would have been in 2 or 3 years in the future, to have possibly discuss a new constitution, which had happened in Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia in previous years. And the elite seized on that, said that Zelaya was trying to use it to get a second term, although he had never, ever mentioned it. And the Honduran constitution very clearly bans a second term or even talking about it by a sitting president. So there was this military coup that threw him out of the country. That then ushered in what we call the post-coup regime, which has been tremendously repressive and tremendously supported by the United States. We don't have the smoking gun saying the United States approved the coup, but certainly Zelaya, the plane carrying Zelaya out of the country, stopped at Soto Cano Air Force Base, the jointly operated Air Force Base. No one thinks that could have happened without U.S. approval. And also, more importantly, the U.S. did everything it could to stabilize the coup. It treated the post-coup dictator, Roberto Micheletti, as an equal to Zelaya. It moved negotiations out of the Organization of American States and into Costa Rica, where the U.S. could then control it. and then just played out the clock until the regularly scheduled presidential elections in November of 2009, several months later. And by the time the elections move around, there's been tremendous repression in the streets for weeks and months and months and months, and there's no way you can have a free or fair election. The military controls the ballots, for example, and most of the opposition candidates have pulled out. So then you have the last man standing, Porfirio Lobo of the National Party. He supposedly wins the election, but it's all international observers have pulled out from observing it because it's so illegitimate, except for the U.S. Republican Party. And the U.S. declares Porfirio Lobo to be the winner, and he's president for the next 4 years. That ushers in 8 years of the U.S., the Obama administration, and then eventually Trump administration, supporting what we call the post-coup regime. And under that regime, the rule of law was devastated. So police corruption that had already been in place is allowed to just completely skyrocket. Drug traffickers and gangs, which had been in place already, just skyrocket in their control of neighborhoods and their extortion and their killings of people who won't cooperate with them. So, and the judiciary becomes spectacularly corrupt. The Congress is mostly corrupt. And so you have this tremendous destruction of the rule of law. And it's not just so then we get this context for the caravan and out-migration. But it's not just that there's random violence and gangs and drug traffickers and that, you know, that often complain the stereotype that the little brown people of Latin America can't govern themselves, because it's actually the U.S.-backed regime, post-coup regime, that is responsible in large part for this destruction of the rule of law. And these folks are themselves criminals at the very top of the Honduran government. If you look at where it's at today, the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was a backer of the coup when he was in Congress in 2009. So there's the first time he's a criminal. In 2000,
a big backer? Somebody who's very...
He was on a chair of a committee in Congress that approved the coup in Congress in 2012. Excuse me, 2009. In 2012, when he was president of Congress, he was leader of something that was called the technical coup. If you want to know about this, it's in my book. Then in which in the middle of the night, the Congress deposed 4 out of 5 members of the constitutional part of the Supreme Court. So that's 4 out of 5 members of what functions as the same as our Supreme Court, and replaced them with new justices the next day, completely, completely illegally. That is known as a technical coup, and Juan Orlando was the very clear leader of that. That Supreme Court, in turn, ruled in support of Juan Orlando and said it was okay for him to run for re-election, even though the Constitution very clearly says no sitting president can be reelected or even advocated. And then the U.S. looked the other way at the technical coup, and that it gave a green light to the decision to allow Juan Orlando to run for reelection, said, well, that's up to the Honduran people, and they have their own democratic practices, which, of course, they don't. And so they were certainly not being democratic or illegal or following the constitutional rule of law. So then Juan Orlando runs for president last year and steals the election very clearly in November, when the government shut down the vote counting machinery when it became clear with a majority, with 57% of the votes in, it was clear that the opposition candidate, Salva Nasrallah, had won. The Honduran government shut down the computers and then eventually over the course of the next week let out data 5% at a time that then supposedly established that Juan Orlando had won the presidency. And this is a man, we can talk about him, but I want to underscore that it's not just that the U.S. supported the coup, it's that they poured money into this illegal regime. They have acted like Juan Orlando is a great guy. For example, John Kelly, currently chief of staff to Donald Trump, has said that Juan Orlando was doing a magnificent job of fighting drugs when there are drug traffickers at the top of the government. The U.S. has green-lighted these post-coup repressive regimes, green light after green light after green light. It's not just U.S. backing the coup that keeps this repressive regime in place.
When we hear from people from Honduras who are part of the caravan coming to the United States border, we oftentimes hear that they're worried that if they were returned, that they would be killed. We hear a lot about the violence of gang activity. Honduras right now has one of the highest, if not the highest, homicide rate in the world. Was it that way 10 years ago?
No, it wasn't at all. And the homicide rates shot up to the highest in the world by 2012. Now, we don't really know what the homicide rate is since then because the Honduran government manipulates the statistics. They've told police not to report to the journalists how many people were killed that week, for example. The minister of security at the time, Arturo Corrales, said on television, well, they don't count so-called irregular murders, which they name as mass murderers or bodies found in plastic bags, which is, of course, many of the murders. So they are clearly manipulating the murder statistics so they can tell the world they've gotten better. Now, the police are very much involved with this kind of killing. The police themselves kill people. They also just look the other way when people are killed. For example, there's gang extortionists in the town of La Lima, and when somebody protests, an old man, for example, protested a couple years ago about having to pay his so-called war tax to the gangs, old man with a small business, the military and police just disappear from the town for 48 hours. The guy is assassinated, and then the military police come back and nothing happens. So we have a lot of documentation that when people report extortion to the police, that they then are killed for having reported it. So the police are corrupt from top to bottom. Now, the government keeps claiming, and so does the State Department, that they've cleaned up the police, and that's clearly not the case. First of all, the National Director of Minister of Security and Defense, in charge of all the military and all the police, Julian Pacheco Tinoco, in power now, has been twice named in U.S. federal court for overseeing drug trafficking flights. The national director of the police and his two top lieutenants who were put in place in January have been documented by the Associated Press to be involved in cocaine trafficking and also intervening in a case when someone was going to be arrested in a case that would have implicated them. So we've got narcos at the very top of the government here, and clearly the State Department knows about this evidence. It's not secret evidence, and is choosing to look the other way. So when we hear, oh, the U.S. is helping the Honduran government lower the homicide rate, or we're helping them clean up the police, or we're helping to fight drug traffickers, it's clear the State Department and the Obama and Trump administration are very much looking the other way at this illegal activity and repression that's being led by the top level of the Honduran government. So when you see reports about the caravan and why people are leaving, you'll hear very excellent analysis of how they're fleeing gangs and drug traffickers who kill people. But also listen to the fine print of the stories. They're often fleeing the police. There's a case of a woman who said, had to flee because I reported voter fraud by the ruling party last winter after the elections, and they came and said they were going to kill me, and I had to flee the country. There was in the caravan in the spring, there was a former Libre opposition congresswoman who was getting threats. So a lot of this is very, very politicized, and it's not just random gangs and violence. And the other factor in here, which we haven't discussed, is the Honduran economy, there's never a golden age, but what was in place in 2009 has in many ways been devastated by the post-coup regime again. And some of it is their model for development forces people out of their livelihoods, whether it's extractive industries and dams that force indigenous people off their lands, and people are killed defending those lands, most famously Berta Cáceres in 2016. It forces campesinos off their farmland to have palm oil instead. It forces the Garifuna Afro-Indigenous people off their lands, their agricultural lands and fishing villages, in order to have corporate tourism along the Honduran coast. And so these models for economic development are actually destroying livelihoods. At the same time, this ongoing neoliberal interventions of the multilateral development banks, which are run by the United States, ultimately, they are destroying the Honduran state still further and cutting back on public services and laying off government workers by the tens of thousands. And you can see some of the statistics in the book. There's a quote from the IMF a couple years ago in which they actually said, we're helping the Honduran government lower their wage bill, meaning lower wages and lay people off who work for the government. So you have this destruction of good jobs, disruption of of a state-run health service because the National Party stole as, and the president stole as much as $90 million from the National Health Service in 2013 to fund their campaign. So you have people dying for lack of dialysis machines, doctors and nurses that don't get paid. So that context, again, it's not a natural disaster. These are the deliberate policies, including the policies of something called the Alliance for Prosperity in the Northern Triangle that the U.S. Has funded big time since beginning in 2015. The proposal came out in 2014. And that money pours right into the same extractive and exploitative model that destroys Honduran people's bodies and their land.
So the United States has has its hand in all of this.
Well, the United States keeps legitimating the government of Juan Orlando Hernandez. It keeps acting like he's a great partner, and that he's our partner in fighting crime, that he's our partner in fighting drug trafficking. When, you know, his brother has been linked to drug trafficking, his minister of security is named as a drug trafficker, his national director of police is the documented drug trafficker. So he himself is this corrupt criminal figure because of the coup, the technical coup, and illegally running for re-election and stealing the election. So we have this repeated criminal at a very high level who routinely destroys the rule of law that becomes our celebrated partner helping. And so what the solution then to the caravan becomes pour even more money into this government. Now, here's where the politics get tricky, because Trump, being Trump, he tweets, oh, cut all the money to Honduran government, as a sort of punishing way of trying to hurt the Honduran government and force them to stop people from leaving. But the answer to that is not, gee, give them a whole lot of money because Trump wants to cut it. Now, let's bracket the humanitarian aid, which is a complex mixed bag. But certainly the United States should not be pouring money into Honduran security forces who have militarized their own border. In fact, they're on the Honduran border trying to stop people from leaving their own country. The military and the police are doing this, and these are U.S.-funded forces that are doing this. The Honduran military police killed 22 people, peaceful protesters and bystanders who protested the elections last year. So those who actually try to achieve social justice and try to support a viable economy in Honduras, like Berta Cáceres, are killed by U.S.-funded military and in the broad sense. And so it's really important to say that we should not be pouring money in there. In fact, people may not know there are 71 members of the U.S. current House of Representatives who co-sponsored the Berta Cáceres Human Rights in Honduras Act. It's H.R. 1299. You can look it up, and it calls for a suspension of U.S. security aid for Honduras until human rights issues are addressed, and also it calls on the United States to vote no on any new loans from multilateral development banks to Honduras. And there are also conditions on aid to the central government to Honduras in the State and Foreign Operations Appropriations Act. Now, the State Department keeps certifying every year that those conditions are met. But it's important that it is U.S. law that the U.S. has to certify that these conditions have been met. Of course, they're not.
Dana Frank is the author of the book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror in the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. Dana Frank is a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She has joined us for a conversation about the history of the United States involvement in Honduras. Dana Frank, that was quite informative, and I thank you greatly.
Thanks a lot. That was really, thank you so much. We have so much time to talk about so much. Thanks, Mitch, and thanks again to Deanna.